Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 3 issues for just £5. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today. Hello and welcome back to Black's History Week. Why has Hercule Poirot's appeal been so enduring, and what does his character owe to Agatha Christie's interests in psychoanalysis and Christian morality? In this episode of Black's History Week, Professor Jeremy Black talks to The Critic's political editor, Graham Stewart, about Belgium's greatest fictional detective.
Professor Jeremy Black, Poirot lasted for 55 years between his first appearance in 1920 and his swan song appearance in 1975. Appeared in 33 novels by Agatha Christie, more than 50 of her short stories, and a couple of plays as well. For Agatha Christie, what was the genesis of Hercule Poirot?
Well, Poirot seems to have drawn on a combination of things, but particularly her experience of Belgian refugees during World War One, but also the idea of an omniscient detective, although one that was very different to Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes. Interestingly enough, in the Poirot story, The Clocks, which comes out in 1963, Hercule Poirot reviews for the benefit of a visitor, sort of Colin Lamb, some of the classics of detective fiction, both real ones, as it were, and ones, notably the novels of Ariadne Oliver, which are false. In other words, there wasn't an Ariadne Oliver other than as a fictional character. And he refers to the Conan Doyle Sherlock Holmes as the master, and he makes it clear that he thinks they are brilliant as stories, but he also is frequently at pains, or Christie is frequently at pains, to differentiate her character from Sherlock Holmes. I wonder if I could, though, just quote from After the Funeral, 1953, which shows how you have to be careful of quotations. So, this is a Poirot story. And the quotation I've picked is about a third of the way through, and it has Timothy saying, so it's 1953, okay, so this Conservative government in Cameron in 1951. Timothy is saying about how the country's going to the dogs, lots of gangsters, and why can't the country get a grip on itself, etc., etc., etc. It all began with that damned Labour government, sending the whole country to blazes, and the government we've got now is now no better. Mealy-mouthed, milk-and-water socialist. Look at the state we're in. Now, you can easily cite that in order to argue that Christie, through that character, is making a criticism along the lines that the Conservative governments that come in 1951 are not too different to Labour. And indeed, as you'll know, I've written a book on the politics of James Bond, and Fleming has the same thing. But then you've got to be so careful. And I want to labour this point because I'm really struck in a lot of the public debate at the moment and how people come in with misleading selective quotations. Because then, what does Christie do? He goes on, you know, he's just said, look at the state we're in. So in other words, the country's in a disaster. Can't get a decent gardener, can't get servants. Poor Maud here has to work herself up to a shadow, messing about in the kitchen. By the way, I think a custard pudding would go well with the sole tonight, my dear. And perhaps a little clear soup first, and we're off. In other words, Timothy comes across as a pompous, unpleasant, selfish man who pretends to be a valetudinarian and who bullies his wife, Maud, and treats her as a servant. And he's quite well off, but he's been rather feckless. So in other words, you have to take the complete quotation, the complete understanding of it. And I think this is more generally the case with Agatha Christie. Too many people are inclined to judge Christie, and indeed Poirot, who of course is a fictional figure, through the television representation, notably, though not only, by David Suchet, who of course is a very fine actor. And I think that's a very good point, because in many senses, and again we go back to James Bond, a tremendous amount about Christie's Poirot.
And what does it and what doesn't it tell? Is the television version of Poirot, particularly, as you say, the David Suchet version, which many of us know well, does it trap Poirot in a particular stage of the novelist's development, or does it simply ignore parts of the complexity of the character that Agatha Christie created?
Well, let's start off by saying, first of all, it is a very good series, and it's not least a very good series because you see, and Suchet is clearly a very talented actor, and I've seen him on stage, he's a very, very good actor. He presents, and the scriptwriters present, a depiction of a character that develops through time, that ages, etc., etc., becomes also in the series, and of course they select the order in which they produce the stories, and they're not in the chronological order, becomes also, they become darker in tone and timbre. But, all praise for Suchet, I have to say, the stories are often not very accurate as an account of the original. Now, you might say you would always need to, if you're taking, let's say, the standard one of the novels in paperback, it's about 200 pages. If you're taking one of those and presenting them in either an hour or 2 hours on television, or half an hour, you obviously would have to be selective. That is true. But in some cases, they are very deliberately misleading. So, for example, take one of the most important of the novels, which is the fifth novel in the sequence, The Big Four. That's the novel between the murder of Roger Ackroyd and the mystery of the Blue Train. The Big Four, which comes out in 1927, was presented in the television version as an illusion. The idea of a conspiracy was an illusion. That is not the novel. In the novel, near the beginning of the novel, set in Paris, which obviously interested Christie, because the beginning of The Mystery of the Blue Train is also set in Paris. But in the beginning of the novel, Poirot and Hastings are in Paris. They survive an attempt to kill them and go back to the hotel, and Poirot explains to Hastings that behind everything, that's his phrase, behind the labour troubles, that's his phrase, behind the Bolshevism, that's his phrase, there is this secret conspiracy, there is a real conspiracy, and the novel is about tracking down this real conspiracy. So, you know, it's very similar to the introduction of Tommy and Tuppence earlier in the 20s, again, fighting it out with conspiracy, and it captures a theme in Christie's writing, which is that Christie is both a thriller writer and a writer of detective stories. She doesn't see them as necessarily incompatible, in other words, one better than the other, or characters to be allocated to one rather than the other. Some of her thrillers, Passenger to Frankfurt, for example, are not particularly great novels. Others of them are better. But what she is very much writing in that respect, is interacting with a tradition of British writing in the thriller style, which is very different to the way in which Suchet essentially is led to present them in terms of, you know, your standard murders. And I think that's important. And again, if I can give another example, take the novels that appear during World War II. Now, these novels, things like the most famous Poirot one is Evil Under the Sun, which comes out in 1941, and which is set on a fictional island, which in fact is Burr Island off the coast of South Devon, which Agatha Christie had stayed at the hotel. And, you know, it's a very fine murder story. You would not have guessed that the war is on. I mean, Burr Island itself during the war was a hotel for wounded RAF personnel. It was bombed by the Luftwaffe. The Luftwaffe seems to have specialised in bombing hospitals. They did the same, and even though they carried large Red Crosses, they did the same at the hospital at Torquay, killing a lot of people. Burr Island was also fortified with pillboxes, observation posts, anti-tank things against tanks landing. So, in fact, the war was very much there. Well, you wouldn't have guessed it to read Agatha Christie, but then British fascists who are willing to collaborate with Hitler in order to establish a new Britain and a new Europe. And the theme is that these people are not so much far right-wing figures, and you know, we're told these people include chief constables, figures in the military, etc., one cabinet member, but they're presented as people who are absorbed by their vanity. And in fact, Agatha Christie, who frequently uses religious language in her stories, and that is something that I'm afraid to say the television and films tend to downplay, refers to them as Lucifers, by which she doesn't mean matches, but she means people that are, you know, bad angels. And that's one of her themes. It is very religious. There is a, she herself was a devout Anglican, and there is a strong sense of a pragmatic, practical Anglicanism about her and the morality she offers in her stories.
Well, you're certainly right. The religious angle doesn't come across in the TV or indeed the film adaptations. In the novels, is Poirot, I mean, he's presumably, being Belgian, he's presumably not Anglican. Is he someone interested in religion?
Oh, no, 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 he's devout. Of how the television does it. it out with his little grey cells. So, you know, in the ABC murders, for example, mm-hmm. after the initial murder, so that's before the subsequent ones, the initial one in Andover, Poirot says, in one sense we know nothing about him, in another sense we know already a great deal. A great need to express his personality. I see him as a child, possibly ignored and passed over. I see him growing up with an inward sense of inferiority, warring with a sense of injustice. I see that inner urge to assert himself, to focus attention on himself, ever becoming stronger. So this is very deliberately contrasted with what is presented as a Holmesian one. And indeed, in that story, Poirot jests with Hastings. The crime was committed by a man of medium height, with red hair and a cast in the left eye. He limps slightly on the right foot and has a mole just below the shoulder blade. And Hastings replied, Hastings comments, for the moment I was completely taken in. And then Poirot says, you fix upon me a look of dog-like devotion and demand of me a pronouncement a la Sherlock Holmes. It's always the clue that attracts you. Alas, that he did not smoke the cigarette and leave the ash, then step in it with a shoe that has nails of a curious pattern. What Christie is doing is deliberately subverting that, which I'm afraid to say a lot of the television versions don't do, and is deliberately trying to present a very contrasting account, one which focuses on a confluence of Christian morality and psychological insight. Jane Marple, exactly the same. And I mean, if you think of some of the other stories, I mean, for example, in Three Act Tragedy, Lady Mary Gore explains some books that I've read these, she's a widow, some books that I've read these last few years have brought a lot of comfort to me. Books on psychology, it seems to show that in many ways people can't help themselves, a kind of kink. It wasn't what I was brought up to believe. I was taught that everyone knew the difference between right and wrong. But somehow, I don't always think that this is so. And Satterthwaite, because he turns up in that story as well as in Mysterious Mr. Quinn, he adds, without acute mania, it may nevertheless occur that certain natures lack what I should describe as breaking power. In some people, the idea or obsession holds. And that's very much her approach. And she, you know, she's interested in psychiatry. She has in her short story, The Red Signal, which comes out in 1933, Sir Arlington West, who we are told is the supreme authority on mental disease. And he explains, suppression of one's particular delusion has a disastrous effect very often. All suppressions are dangerous, as psychoanalysis has taught us. And, you know, I mean, Christie and Marple in their Poirot and Marple and Quinn in their different ways, you know, bring that out. And they do use the language of evil. I mean, in A Pocket Full of Rye, Marple remarks, this is a wicked murderer, Inspector Neil, and the wicked should not go unpunished. And Neil, who is a sympathetic and bright interlocutor of Marple, replies, that is an unfashionable belief nowadays, not that I don't agree with you. So what you've got a very strong context in which you've got Christian morality and psychoanalysis brought together in order to understand people. And in a sense, you know, each story varies, but in a sense, sin is a common element. And that's why, you know, I hope listeners will know the opus, I hope I'm not giving anything away, but that's why in Curtin, which was written in about 1940, though it doesn't come out till the end, in Curtin, you know, Hercule Poirot is deeply concerned about the way in which he is in effect committing sin in order to catch a murderer who cannot otherwise be caught.
Very interesting what you say, not only about religion, but about psychoanalysis. Do we have much evidence that Agatha Christie, her interest in psychoanalysis was based upon any sustained reading on the subject?
Yeah, she did, and she was, you know, I mean, again, one of the great problems with the way people present past generations, and you can see this all the way back, is the idea that we, whatever we are in some way talented, reformers, perceptive, and the people in the past writing about her, was to present her as being a very narrow character that acted in defence of a sort of conservative vision of England and was quaint and foolish and etc., 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 and limited. And that it was after World War II that you get more perceptive writers who engage with crime in a more informed fashion, and that Christie should be thrown away as an example of a dated heritage industry, or the BBC should be allowed to present programmes which bear, as the recent ones do, absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with the Christie stories. Well, I have to tell you, that might sound to some people listening, may sound to writers of being The Guardian to be absolutely apparent, but it rests on a complete ignorance of her writing, or indeed of many other writers. Christie is fundamentally concerned not with social context, she is fundamentally concerned with morality and themes of redemption and retribution, and also that murder is an unbalanced characteristic and modus operandi. If you think that is the case, then you should find it equally of interest, whatever the setting is in. And as far as the actual context in which she wrote, despite the arguments of some people that everything is being set in some sort of quaint version of the English countryside, St. Mary Mead, for example, many of the stories are not. There are stories that are set in the Middle East, both during the Middle East before World War II, but also afterwards. Passage to Baghdad, for example, in 1951, is a Cold War novel. You may or may not like it. It's to do with, the argument is, and the thesis essentially is, it's another version of her interest in thrillers, that it's a good thing if the British and the Soviets can talk to each other, sorry, and the Americans can talk to each other, but there is a disturbing force out there that doesn't want them to do so. It's about that, and it's about those people having infiltrated British intelligence, etc., etc. Now, you might or might not like the story. It's actually quite a page-turner. But the point is, it's certainly not St. Mary Mead. Nor, for that matter, even if you like your, as it were, closed, sort of limited cast murderers, The Mystery of the Blue Train is not, St. Mary Mead. Nor, for that matter, is Murder on the Orient Express. So there's actually quite a lot of variation in the ABC murders, which is 1936. The first murder, which is in Andover, enables Christie to write a depiction of really quite poor and humble people and to do it well. The second murder is in Bexhill. She then offers, as it were, as opposed to the rock bottom poor, she does the genteel poor. Then she goes to, as it were, the social elite, the murder set in Churston. And then she brings much more to the foreground the person that's being framed, Cust, who is a poor and rather limited commercial traveller. So the idea that this is all some, murder in the vicarage type story is just not true. But obviously, it's easier for people, and I have to say this, and I would sort of focus on this, I'd like to underline this. Many of the people that make glib remarks about Christie or other writers have based themselves on a very limited textual understanding, and that's why I began deliberately by running on my quotation, because all too many people would just have taken the first bit of it, or for that matter the second bit, and not looked at both of them. And I find this very limiting as a historian. I mean, people sometimes say to me, why are you as a historian writing on such and such a topic? As you may know, I just brought out a book on Jane Austen. There's excellent literary studies on Jane Austen. And I will say to them, well, because I think that history as an academic subject has many flaws. And I have to tell you, loads of modern historians, I would say they drive me to despair. No, actually, I think most of them are just not worth bothering with. But I think done well in the 19th century tradition of source criticism, and I was lucky enough as an undergraduate at Cambridge to focus or be focused on medieval understand source criticism, because otherwise you end up producing what is happening all too often, which is people offering a random selection of quotations shaped to match their a priori understanding, and then asserting on the basis of that whatever case they wish for. So Christie is complex, which is what you'd expect. Some of her murder stories are better written than others, and I'm saying that not simply as a sort of lazy observation. She made the same point, just as she said, some of her stories were her favourites and some of them were not. Some of them have been more commercially successful than others. The most commercially successful, of course, is And Then There Were None, a brilliant one based on an island, which again was inspired by Berg Island, in which everybody who is invited there dies, again with retribution for sin being the driving force, but a brilliant solution. The murder of Roger Ackroyd, again, you know, as I said, I'm assuming people know these plots, which is what really made her name, 1926. Again, an absolutely astonishing but totally fair. And I say totally fair, I mean, she did deal with this issue of fairness. She comments, for example, on The Mystery of the Yellow Room, not one of hers, in which she said some people criticised it as not fair. She said it is fair. And of course, by fair, what you mean is the evidence is all there in order for the reader to work it out before or at the same time as the detective or the detecting agency, as it were, whichever that is, does so. But obviously the author adds all sorts of misdirection in order to conceal it. Now, Christie was very keen on providing misdirection, but of making it fair. But, of course, what that requires is a very close attention to what people are saying, which is why with Poirot or with Marple, whatever, they are introduced into the action, sometimes in an implausible fashion, but that's the nature of the plot, in order that they can listen to people. And to a great extent, you asked me about the David Suchet ones. In great way, they went wrong. Well, they didn't go wrong. They said lots of people enjoyed them. That's not going wrong. But where they could have been different is that Agatha Christie's stories are really large chunks of dialogue and would be better handled on radio than in television, because it's about what people are saying and how there are inconsistencies and how those inconsistencies are understood, anticipated, clues are left, and how then there is a resolution by working out from those inconsistencies what happens. Now, clearly, that is not an accurate account of crime. We know that. Most criminal action, it is not too difficult to work out who did it. Many of them are brawls or, at the present moment, of course, violence between or involving gangsters, violence between or involving drugs and such like. So the kind of murders that we are talking about are relatively uncommon. But that does not mean that they do not provide the narrator, in this case Christie, with an opportunity to make her moral points and to set her puzzles and to display her ingenuity. And I think she does so very, very well indeed. If I might add another comment on a commentator here, George Orwell in 1946 in Tribune brought out a sort of rather ephemeral piece on the one that's often cited because it's written by Orwell, and our Orwell supposedly has iconic flaws. Although, like any writer, he clearly did things that were less good than others. And, of course, it's famously on the decline of the English murder, and he argues that there used to be these poisonings and that they were all to do with respectability. He then comments on a recent murder in which had been essentially one which was violent and there wasn't any crude. And he argues that this is part of an Americanization of British a small number of famous murder cases which involved much more problematic accounts than he is suggesting. But what is interesting is that Orwell was yet another one of these writers who was only too keen to offer a caricature of, quote, the English murderer. And I say the English because, not because we're obviously British, but the reason I say the English one is that we're talking about Agatha Christie, and Agatha Christie very rarely uses the term British or Britain. Mm. She almost always refers to the English or England.
Well, what's particularly interesting is, of course, is she's writing about English people, or mostly English people, or even when set abroad, mostly English people involved. But Poirot is a Belgian. Was that a device, do you think, so that, you know, he would have the outsider's cool analysis and perspective of the English character? Or was it just she developed this this character who was Belgian? You mentioned her interest in the Belgian refugees from the First World War, and he was successful, so she stuck with him.
Yes, I mean, obviously, when you say she stuck with him, I mean, she developed quite a range of characters. But yes, I mean, the mysterious, he works for the mysterious affair at Stiles. After all, you have to explain, although it comes out in 1920, it's set in the war. Hastings, who is the narrator, is a captain. He's been badly wounded at the Battle of the Somme. He's brought back to Britain to convalesce. Why should he meet somebody else in Britain who could be a combatant? You know, there's conscription on. So he obviously meets somebody who is elderly. Poirot is presented as fairly elderly from the start, and whom he knew pre-war as a Belgian policeman, and Belgians are in England. So to that extent, it is a device which works quite well. And Poirot, of course, has the ability as an outsider to be both quaint. In other words, there are things that could be said about him, as in those quaint things, because there is a comic element in Agatha Christie, and Poirot is often unconscious, as with Hastings. There are unconsciously quite a lot of Poirot making deliberate jokes at Hastings' expense, Hastings commenting on what he sees as ridiculous aspects of Poirot. So it's a humour dimension, but it also works. Then the next story, The Murder on the Lynx, which doesn't follow till 23, the next story is set in France. And, you know, from that point of view, to have a Belgian who can talk French to the French detectives makes, you know, a lot of sense. The next one, there's some short stories in 24 Poirot investigates. The next one, The Murder of Roger Ackroyd, which is what really takes off, which is 1926, Poirot is retired to the English countryside. The doctor, who, you know, I take it I'm not revealing anything to anybody here, though you'll have read it, the doctor who despises Poirot, despises just about everybody, in fact, the doctor, in a way, part of the way that he underrates Poirot is precisely that Poirot is this foreigner. So I think that element is important to it. And the same thing happens in a variety of other novels, in Three Act Tragedy, which comes out in 1935, where again a lot of the action is set in Devon. Agatha Christie spent a lot of time in Devon. The villain, and indeed the same thing happens in the ABC murders in 36, the villain is really rude to Poirot on the grounds that he's a foreigner. And Christie uses that relationship, as it were, to cast light on what she considers true Englishness. And of course, I don't know if you remember Death in the Clouds, which is 35. The inquest jury initially want to return, murder, the verdict on the woman that's died in the plane from France. They initially want to bring the case against Poirot because he's a foreigner and they don't like him as a foreigner. So it provides an opportunity to comment on the English. I mean, one of the interesting things is that there is a what we would call a racist dimension would say, unpleasantly anti-Semitic remarks. And I would say that some of the other 1920s novels, so that's 33, some of the early 1920s novels, you know, are about Bolsheviks and Jews and the two being linked. I mean, you certainly see that at the beginning of The Mystery of the Blue Train in 28. But what's interesting is by the late 30s, she's very much having what you might call xenophobic anti-foreigner remarks given to unattractive figures. Mm. And she's already, as I've said, started that bit earlier. And that becomes even more acute after World War II. So it's very interesting. You see that development in her style. I mean, politically, she's not easy to place. I mean, she's not, as you know, I wrote a book on the politics of James Bond. Fleming is easier to place politically, which is understandable because his character has to play a major role vis-a-vis the Cold War. I would say that if you were thinking of how best to play and place Christie politically, it's the kind of one nation, national government Toryism of Baldwin in the 30s. And the kind of, you know, she doesn't like the far right. She's very pejorative indeed about Mosley and the, you know, his version of National Socialism. She's pretty down on what she sees as ignorant people trying to recreate a new, so she sees these people as being on the left and on the far right, trying to create a new England, a new world, in accordance with some sort of ideology which is essentially anti-human. And that's a theme that links her writing in the thrillers to her writing in the detective stories. In the detective stories, it's often the hubris of the individual that leads their arrogance, their Lucifer quality in that case, that leads them to murder and then to further murder. And some of the murders are very unpleasant. I mean, the ABC murders, there's additional murders which are unnecessary to the murderer, but just to try and create confusion. And in Three-Act Tragedy, there's a murder to just practice the, as it were, means of doing it. So these are really evil, wicked people, and there's no two ways about it. They are presented accordingly. But the there's a very different, wider presentation of the same scenario when you're looking at the thrillers, because they're looking at conspiracies. But again, the same sort of idea. You know, these are people that have some brilliant idea which makes them special. And, you know, as I mentioned, Passage to Baghdad discusses this at some considerable length. And they're megalomaniacs and they're murderers accordingly. And in a way, the commonality in the case of both the detective story and the thriller is that in each case, it's necessary to work out a conspiracy to detect, but the scale of the conspiracy and its ambition is different. But to take Agatha Christie and say she just wrote detective novels is an absurdity. It's rather like if you were to say that Conan Doyle just wrote Sherlock Holmes. I mean, it's just a complete absurdity. But I'm afraid to say, you know, a lot of commentators make these rather absurd remarks.
Well, I want to place Hercule Poirot in the context of some of the recurring characters that appear around him. Obviously, Captain Hastings, the very sort of English gentleman foil.
Captain Hastings, who ends up as Major Hastings. Captain Hastings goes off to the Argentina. He marries the woman he calls Cinderella, and he goes off he meets her in Murder on the Links. He goes off, and he's away for a long, long time. So again, the television suggested a more greater prominence for him, as indeed it did for Miss Lemon and Inspector Japp. I mean, Poirot is generally presented... I mean, there are some characters that recur. My favourite one who recurs is Ariadne Oliver, who wrote Snow on the Sphinx. Slightly absurd the detective novels, and of course a brilliant foil for Agatha Christie, and very, very clever. I mean, one has to remember that she had a capacity... If you read them as humour, I mean, some of them are not humorous at all, but some of them, the interchanges between the characters, they are really very humorous. And Ariadne Oliver, she had sort of nasty things happen around her, but she is also a character of genuine interest. So you're going to say I cut it.
I mean, I was just going to suggest talking about, actually, Miss Lemon as well. Is she like a Mrs. Hudson figure in Sherlock Holmes, but updated for a more sort of interwar... secretary, personal assistant sort of role, or really is it wrong to make those sort of connections? She should be seen in her own terms.
Well, I think you should see her in her own terms. Of course, she isn't sustained as a Mrs. Hudson's role. In fact, George, the valet, is rather sustained in that role, and George is there, well, in fact, he is there in the sense he gets sent away in Curtain. So George is there to the end in Agatha Christie's interpretation of the character, and George, in a way, is more convincing a sort of valet, and also somebody that can cook. Whereas Miss Lemon, I think, is more that from the point of view of television, you needed a female character, she is pushed to the fore. And I mean, these days, a lot of the classic detective stories are hitting trouble because people or script writers or directors want to write in female characters. Sometimes it's absurd. So there's a version of Body in the Library in which part of the driving force of the double murder is a lesbian relationship between the two protagonists. Well, the only problem with that is, as you will know if you've read the story, which presumably you're not supposed to do, as you will know, there are not those two protagonists. There's one of them who is a woman and the other one is a man, and they are secretly married, but that's not a lesbian relationship. Give you another example. The Sittaford Mystery. They did a wonderful television version of that, set in the 50s. It's an impressive story. It was interesting, but it's not what the plot of the novel is. And you just have to think to yourself, I'm not quite sure where we're getting from on that. And to me, I'm an author, and I do believe that you should say, if somebody produces a different version, it should be said, based on an idea by Graham Stewart or based on a character devised by Jeremy Black, but don't call it William Shakespeare's Hamlet if you're going to play it with Maxine Peake as Hamlet having a relationship with a female Ophelia. It just doesn't work.
Well, we're drawing to a close, and in the end Agatha Christie kills off Hercule Poirot in appropriately titled Curtain, her final Poirot novel, although not in the sequence in which she wrote it.
And she doesn't kill off Jane Marple, incidentally. Okay, go on.
Yes, so do you think when the end came for Poirot, it was with some relief for Agatha Christie? Had she wearied of him? Or what was the nature of her relationship with her character?
Well, again, you've got the problems of selective quotation. There is a remark she made in 1930 in which she said she was fed up with him. But, you've got to be very, very, very careful with selective quotation. I mean, she kept him going, and, you mentioned Curtin, which was written in 1940, though not published till 75, but Elephants Can Remember, 72, Halloween Party, 69, third girl, 66, the clock, 63. I think I'm making my point. You know, she went on using him. And he, of course, represented an opportunity. I mean, he could be brought in at different stages. So in After the Funeral, which is 1953, he's brought in because Entwistle, who is the lawyer, is unhappy about things. But it takes two deaths before Poirot is brought in. And so that's very different from, you know, having a scene where, as it were, he's present from the outset, as in Murder on the Orient Express, for example. So I think that one of the interesting points about using a character frequently, this is one of the successes of being a writer and one of the reasons you should replay some of your characters, is you don't have to endlessly explain to the reader whom they are. That character is already constructed, and you can then rely on a certain degree of almost automatic response and contextualization by your reader, and you can save space accordingly. And the more intricate a plot you're trying to devise, and Christie is brilliant at intricate plots, the more you can do that. I mean, of course, the same thing is true of other people, of other characters who repeat by other distinguished novelists, Gideon Fell, for example, or, you know, Humphrey Merriweather. They turn up repeatedly. So that what you've got are writers who are very skillful in that respect, but also, and this is one of the particular qualities of Christie, she also writes very successfully using other detectives, and she also writes, of course, her plays, which are very successful. She writes, she's brilliant at short stories, and to write a short work is much harder than to write a long work. And she's also really effective at her Mary Westcott stories, you know, her non-detective ones. So I think that you have to capture, if you're talking about Agatha Christie, a three-dimensional writer who has been caricaturized as a two-dimensional one. And this contrast between, I just want to end on this, two-dimensionality and three-dimensionality is where I fear a lot of modern society or intellectual life is stuck. In other words, people take a topic or an issue, like a particular view on it or a side in it, they in fact turn it into a duality of sides and make their assessment accordingly and then fit everything else in accordance with that view. And I'm afraid to say, ashamed to say, this is true of all too many of so-called public intellectuals and historians as well. Because the reality of life is that their issues are complex, people are complex. You need to see not just, as it were, both points of view, but many points of view in order to understand something. You need to understand that most issues are multipolar, multi-centered, multifaceted, and you need to be able to contextualize them. And I'm afraid to say, and also crucially, to respond to something by thinking about it, not feeling it. Now, I'm afraid to say most people don't want to do that. Maybe a lot of them aren't capable of it. But what really irritates me is people who are supposed to be clever, who have, you know, degrees from reasonable universities, who have doctorates, who call themselves or are called professor. I know the title has been debased in recent years, but that should still mean something. And what I find really disappointing is how many people who are, you know, I don't mind stupid people making stupid remarks. What I object to is people who are actually got some mental capacity making stupid remarks, and that seems to be happening too much at the moment.
Well, on that broader point, we must leave it there. But Professor Jeremy Black, thank you very much for explaining the world of Agatha Christie's Hercule Poirot.
If you've enjoyed listening to The Critic podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the offer of 3 issues for just £5 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.